Welcome, everyone, to the Goalster podcast, where we take you behind the scenes with guests of all shades and styles and their fascinating and enriching stories about their lives, their victories, their failures, their ambitions, and, of course, their books. I'm Humphrey Hawksley, your host for the duration, and today we're talking about crime fiction, hard-boiled, cozy, thriller, detective, and what makes a bestseller. Please enjoy. And to find out more, check us out on www.goalster.co.uk. And without further ado, I'm going to count to five and we begin. Hello and welcome wherever you are in the world. My name is Humphrey Hawksley. I'm your host for the next hour on our Goalster Inside Story, where we are going to be discussing crime, private detectives, baseball, really anything we want, because it's a Goalster show, and I've got a great guest today who in a previous incarnation was a reporter for the American Forces Network and handled media relations for the Pentagon. Just look at him there, what a strapping figure, so be warned. He has, as we say, a way with words, and that's why we're so lucky, because we've also booked him. I think this is right. I might be 24 hours out, but on the very day that his latest of his really successful Hannibal Jones crime thriller series is released. Yep, we've nailed him on publication day. And don't contradict me on that, even if it's not exactly. We are going to talk about the latest book, Subtle Felonies. How on earth does one get such catchy titles? What is it about? We can talk about American publishing, Black publishing, diversity publishing, and everything that swirls around a good crime story. And I'm now going to let him take the lead. Welcome, Austin Escamacho, to Goalster Inside Story.
Good morning, everyone. I'm always happy to be here, mostly because Humphrey is such a hoot to talk to.
Now, just to remind everybody, because you're looking fresh and everything, what time is it there in the morning?
It is 7 a.m. here on the East Coast of the United States, and I have my second cup of coffee with me, and I managed to remember to put a shirt on. I feel like I'm ahead of the game.
Okay, anybody that thinks Austin doesn't look so great, just let us know, okay? Because he can handle it. I think he looks fantastic. Now, I've got a curious question as I was preparing for this show. Your name is Austin Escamacho. Now, my name is Humphrey Hawksley, but I don't call myself Humphrey W. Hawksley, but over in your side of the pond, everybody's got this middle initial. Well, can you answer why?
Well, I can only answer for myself, and okay, there's an actual reason. My grandfather immigrated to this country, so I'm the second generation born here. And he was Augustine Camacho. And my father is Austin Emmanuel Camacho. And as I've dug through the genealogy, it goes back at least one more generation. So there are a lot of Austin Camachos out there. My son is Austin Adam Camacho. And his son is Austin Elric Camacho. So to distinguish myself from all the other great guys, I use my middle initial. My middle name is Seth. Which is a biblical name. I don't know how popular that name might be in the UK, but
no, we don't have Seth, but that explains it, because I think in the States you quite often get a son named after a father and so on, whereas yes, I'm named after my grandfather but not my father, so we tend not to do it, so we don't need the middle initial.
Well, I think that all the men in my family agreed that nobody wants to be junior or the third. So by having different middle names, no one is junior.
isn't President Biden junior? Isn't he?
Yes, he is.
He is a junior, isn't he? Yes, and then what happens when you're one down from there? Do you become extra large junior or extra junior?
I actually have one friend who is generally called Trey by everyone in his family because he's the third with the exact same name.
Oh, my God.
I don't know what happens after that.
You know why I love this conversation with you, Austin? Because I have this thing, the only stupid question is the one you never ask, and I've now learned something that that I just thought. And now I have another question that brings you to your work, because we mustn't get too diverted. The cover of Subtle Felonies, which I haven't got yet because it's only out today, but I'm going to describe it. It's got the back of a guy looking out of a massive floor-to-ceiling window in an unfurnished room with polished floorboards, and there's a slice, you can just see a slice of a ball on the floor. Now, how and who on earth comes up with this stuff?
Well, the cover artist had little to work with except my little write-up of what the story is about, my little synopsis there. And she knows it's a mystery, so it had to look mysterious, right?
Yeah.
And that gentleman standing there is meant to be Hannibal. He is standing actually in the closet of this mansion house. The man who is missing that he's trying to find was a professional basketball player. So she wanted to have a little hint of basketball in the room.
Yeah.
And I guess she just threw those elements together. And what do I know? I'm a word guy, not a picture guy. So I said, yeah, go.
Well, I mean, I think it looks great because I noticed it and decided to talk about it with you means that it's hit me in some way and I remembered it exactly. But this thing about the back of the hero that is in all these thrillers, why is that? Why can't we see? I've told that if you see the front of a person, it's cozy crime. If you see the back of a person, it's a hard-boiled thriller.
Oh. I don't know. I mean, I've noticed it, but I don't know why. Maybe they want you to have your own imaginary picture of what the person looks like, and if they show you his face, then it's too late. I have noticed that on romance novels, at least here, it is very popular to show a man from the neck down. You don't see his face on the cover.
Really?
Yeah. That's the thing. Weird, but true.
So that's a romance novel of which most of the readers are women. Is that right?
Of course. Yes. Yes.
So they don't want to see the face.
I guess they don't care. They don't care what our face is. I think it's very dehumanizing. If I wrote a book and the cover of the book just showed a woman from the neck down, I think I'd be shot.
You'd be canceled. You'd be sensitively edited, wouldn't you? Which we're going to talk about because amongst your many skills, you run editorial sensitive don't offend people courses. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm a sensitivity. What do they call those people?
Sensitivity guru.
Oh, something like that.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. But firstly, I want to know about Hannibal and his sensitivities. Now, I'm just going to read some blurb that I've got. It's a retired basketball star. This is for Subtle Felonies, the cover
right.
We just discussed. A retired basketball star, Xander Brown, goes missing. His wife calls Hannibal Jones, that's your series hero, for help. And we delve into a world of money, music, sport, and murkiness. I don't know who wrote that. I might have written it. However, let us start with Hannibal Jones. Who he's not you, is he?
No.
You're sure about that?
He's not me. Maybe there's an element of who I'd like to be, but he's certainly not me. Hannibal Jones is first of all, I always refer to him as an African American character, but in fact he is mixed race. His mother is German. Whom his father married when he was in the army. And as near as I can figure, he was the first mixed race lead character in a popular book, at least over here. So maybe I started something.
Yeah.
But he used to be in the Secret Service, and now he's a private detective living in Washington, D.C. And he's kind of, he calls himself a troubleshooter. He helps people out of whatever kind of a jam they're in. So he does all the detective-y stuff, you know. And of course, every book, there's a murder he has to solve, or there's a missing person he has to find, or something of that nature. I think in an earlier era, we may have referred to him as a knight errant or something like
that. Okay. So he's the guy, and because he's not connected to the Secret Service or anything anymore, he can basically do what he wants. So where, and I firstly want to know, where is his moral compass? Because he has to judge that himself. He doesn't have a rule book, does he?
I will tell you something that did not seem controversial when I started writing these books, but over time it's become more of a question. Hannibal is very conservative. He's very old school. And in the books I get to play with the notion of that fine line between chivalry on the one hand and misogyny on the other. He is that guy who does treat women differently than he treats men. And he's the hold the door open, carry the bags kind of guy in a world where that is no longer considered the height of being a great guy.
I want to put that wonderful phrase you just put, that fine line between chivalry and misogyny, I want to put that out to our audience and get their views on it, because that, and is Austin chivalrous or is he a misogynist? We can work that out towards the end of the show, and then we'll. But no, it's a really interesting point you raise. So we're going to talk about more when we talk about your editorial sensitivity things. But okay. But by creating Hannibal as he is, and you said he's the Secret Service, he's this fine line between misogyny and that. Are you doing it because of what character sells, or are you doing it because of what you feel inside you as a writer you want to create?
I think I have to write the people as I'm feeling them. And in the years before, when I started doing all of this, Hannibal Jones was simply my idea of what a hero is. And my idea of what a hero is probably based on the Westerns that I watched when I was a child and the comic books that I read when I was a child. And for me, I guess Hannibal is more black and white than the world is right now. The world is all grays.
Just describe for me what your idea of a hero was when you were growing up. Just give us that pen picture.
There are right ways to be, and one of those ways is honesty. I think that what drives Hannibal through most of these stories is that he is absolutely determined to find the truth. And the truth is not as popular today as it was when I was a child. There is a truth, and that's what he wants to know. But also someone who is trustworthy, someone who is loyal to the people around him, helpful, and, you know, a good Boy Scout, I guess, is the way I might describe it.
So if you were designing Hannibal, this is hugely speculative, but you jolted my curiosity. If you were designing Hannibal today, would he have a different set of values?
That is an interesting question. I'm working on a new series, not published yet, but the central character is a professional assassin. And she has a very different moral compass from Hannibal. She's killing people for money. And her number one, the number one rule for this character, Skye, is the bastard's got to deserve it.
Right.
Which is a very different view of what a hero might be.
So does Hannibal ever take the law into his own hands When he gets the guy, does he hand him over to him or her over to the authorities, or does he cut their heads off and tip them over a cliff?
Well,
I'm not asking for spoilers, but generally speaking,
nothing to that extent. But there are definitely moments in my books where what's happening in Hannibal's mind is, give me an excuse. Please do something that will warrant me beating you half to death. Or, you know, he will pull his gun and say, you know, please try to run. Or something like that. But I don't think he ever really takes the law. Yeah, I don't think he ever really takes the law in his own hand. He might bend a little bit, but he won't break.
So your assassin character against Hannibal, your assassin makes her rules completely and, of course, goes outside of the law. So she's the judge, and there's no checks and balances at all in what she does.
And to this character, to an extent, much like Hannibal, there are good guys and bad guys. But to this character, the bad guys should be shuffled off this mortal coil.
Particularly if there's a check.
Cancel your subscription right now.
I want to stick to this theme, but before I get back to it, give us what you can without the spoilers of subtle felonies. So Xander Brown, is he a nice guy, nasty guy? How does it just give us that theme?
I think the hardest thing I do in my professional side of my life, the hardest thing I do is talk about my books, which are mysteries, without giving anything away. But you're right. Hannibal is called by the wife of Xander Brown. Xander Brown was a basketball superstar. And what that means here is literally rags to riches. You go from playing on the schoolyard court to multi-million-dollar annual contracts. He's gone missing. The wife doesn't know. Maybe he's run off with another girl, or maybe he has gotten back into drugs and he's lying somewhere asleep. But she hires Hannibal to find him because she doesn't want it to be in the news, whatever it is. She wants to protect her daughter and herself from that kind of thing. So in going to look for this man, Hannibal has to meet his friends and the people he does business with and go to the clubs that he likes to hang out in. And what we learn, I think, is that a lot of people stay close to someone who has a lot of money for reasons other than I like you. Or sometimes it's a combination of I like you, but wow, it pays off to be around you. Yeah. And I liked in this book playing with this concept of you know, when you go out, you got your posse with you. Well, who are those people and what do they really think of you and what do you really think of them? So there's a lot of that mixed in with the mystery of where is Xander?
So you've got Hannibal looking and checking all these things. And we were talking about the moral compasses of your two characters, including Hannibal before. But the reader of these books you have to get all the readers on side of whether they're a dreadful assassin or whether they're a sort of better guy like Hannibal. And I'm thinking that in The Godfather, for example, Mario Puzzi got everybody to love The Godfather. And Michael Corleone, Al Pacino, and in the film. That must be really difficult to get the sympathy of the reader.
I think the key is there are certain positive traits that we like about people, and we like a person who has a strong personality. We like a person that whatever it is that they believe, they stick to it no matter what. In the case of Hannibal Jones, it is, you know, I want the truth. And even if it's hurtful to me, even if it's hurtful to my friends, even if it's embarrassing or whatever, but the truth is the thing. In the case of Sky, my assassin, it is all about the bad guys are the bad guys, but I won't hurt anyone else. She follows a number of hard, fast rules. And one of the rules that she follows, one of what she calls the assassin's rules, don't kill everybody in the room. You don't, you target the guy that you're targeting. She doesn't kill children. She doesn't kill women. She is very, because I think on some level, Sky realizes that if you step outside this box, it's chaos. Mm. Chaos is bad. And as long as she keeps to her rules, and the police don't chase her too hard.
Okay.
You know, when the police come upon a dead man and they say, oh, well, this is the guy who was abusing these children in the schoolyard, and we couldn't get enough evidence to take him down, and now he's dead. They don't work too hard on that case.
And do you ever create, as you're working us through this, because I'm finding this fascinating on the mind, do you ever create a bad guy who is not quite that bad that we might like him, and you suddenly find you don't like him, or Sky's after him and you think, actually, she's quite nice, how could she possibly kill him?
I think that every bad guy has some good traits, or at least I try to explain the reason. No, you know, not for everyone, of course. Child molesters are in their own package. They're just bad people, period.
Okay.
But sometimes you will encounter someone who is a, at least in Hannibal's universe, there are people who are smugglers or swindlers. They're just doing fraud to make a living. And those people can have positive traits. I have coming up in the future book, there is a smuggler who is a big-time smuggler, and you naturally think to yourself, well, smugglers are bad people. But you later find out that, among other things, he is smuggling medicine into countries where normally only the leaders get the medicine. He's smuggling cigarettes into Russia because they want them. Well, is that evil? Jeez, I don't...
This is murky moral compass. So I need to ask you a personal question now. Not that we're not being personal, but your previous life, you were working as the press guy, media guy with the Pentagon.
Yeah.
And the Pentagon is the military arm of the United States, and the United States has enemies. So when you were dealing in those situations, did you think of the enemies as bad guys, or did you sort of understand them? Who were the enemies in your era?
You know, in my younger days, I absolutely did think in terms of everybody who's not on our side is the bad guys, is the villains. Later in my career, I came to see things a little differently, and I guess it's the way I see things now. I think that a country is not a mental monolith. Right now, this minute, I don't think that the Russians are bad. I happen to think that Putin is a bad person. I think the average Russian is probably like the average American. And when he gets up in the morning, he doesn't think I hate America. He thinks, I got to get groceries.
And I want another cup of coffee.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly.
I've kind of changed in that regard. I still believe that there are bad people in the world. And I believe that we don't have good systems for weeding them out. Unfortunately, to be fair, you have to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. You're innocent until proven guilty and all that. I think it's pretty much the same in your country. And that makes it very, very difficult to actually get the bad actors.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and we in our books and our movies, we see our bad guys slightly different to your guys. I mean, your guys are always just get massacred, whereas our guys might get handcuffed. So there's a sort of a different. But Austin, when you were with the Penny, who were the enemies then? What era were we talking? Was it Afghanistan, Iraq, or before that, or
Iraq initially, and yes, Afghanistan. I'm working on a book now that deals with some Somali warlords.
Okay.
I definitely saw those as bad guys, but do they see themselves as bad guys? No. You know, the Somali warlord might simply be the guy who's trying to bring some order to this chaos, and the way to bring order is to be in control of everything. Yeah. You know? You stole all this food from the United Nations, but what are you doing with it? Maybe if he's distributing it to his village because everybody in his village is hungry. So, you know, it's harder and harder.
And yet, I mean, it's and when you were younger, you said that if anybody that wasn't on your side was an enemy.
Right.
But as said, I mean, we are talking to you, I should tell our wonderful audience, we're talking to you from the heart of Washington, D.C., more or less, or that environment yes. around there. So you are right in the middle of that. Is that changing a bit now? Is there a thought, well, maybe they're not a democracy and maybe they do have a warlord, but maybe they're okay, a bit like what you said, or is it?
I fear that the opposite is true. I fear that more and more people are seeing good guys, bad guys, and that's that. Here in our country, we have a huge, terrible division between the political parties, and everybody on the right thinks that everybody on the left is evil, and everybody on the left thinks everybody on the right is evil, and I'm kind of that guy in the middle saying, no, we're all Americans. We should be on one team. But that's harder and harder to do.
Yeah. And that blur, I mean, we've had a bit of that here. We have discussed it with various people about these sort of divisions and that is the, but that will bring me naturally on to, but I have a question about subtle felonies I want to ask you before okay. I go naturally on to your role as a sensitivity editor, because that brings up a lot of these issues. Give us an example of when you start a book and you're establishing Hannibal Jones and his mission, you have to give him an obstacle that we as the reader think, how the hell is he going to get out of this? Or where does he go from here? Are you able to, without giving too much away, tell us what Hannibal comes up against, if not in this book, in a previous one?
Well, in general, Hannibal's cases start out as a missing person or something stolen that he wants to retrieve, or perhaps a woman is being abused by her husband and, you know, her neighbors want him to get involved to try to straighten that out or something like that. But what the big barriers to him generally are figuring out who is doing the bad thing. So I always start with a bad thing. In this case, okay, we've got a man who's missing, and we don't know if he's just missing because he's being stupid or because someone has done something to him. Well, we need to find out, and it's not a crime that the police focus on very hard. Mm-hmm. Adult missing persons who have big money, the police, well, you know, he's wandered off to do his thing. There's no proof that anything bad has happened, and we're busy. That's why you call in a private detective.
Yeah.
And Hannibal, I think, is unusually sensitive to what somebody like you and me would consider a real problem. You know, if your spouse goes missing, for you, that's a real problem. The police might not see it as a big deal. People that I know personally, if their dog goes missing, it's a big problem.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a personal connection there. So and, those are the barriers that handle, and what is fun in the writing, in building the puzzle, is to introduce all of these people who might be involved. In the case of Subtle Felonies, the man who handles the money for this family, he kind of likes the daughter. And so maybe he has a reason for disappearing Xander. Xander's best friend lives on the property in one of the guest houses. And he was a basketball player too. And there's a certain amount of jealousy there. And maybe he has a reason. You know, it turns out that Xander has a girlfriend that he goes and visits in Baltimore. Yeah. Maybe she has a reason for pulling him. So, That's the fun, introducing all these other people.
And do you call these red herrings? Because
yes,
these red herrings over there, and then yes, one of them, they all are credible, and then one of them is going to come on.
It's going to be it, right.
I now want to get on to your sensitivity editors, but I wanted to tell our audience that we're going to talk now about, we talked about chauvinism and misogyny, that narrow line, the changing landscape of what's good and bad, acceptable, not acceptable, and we're going to talk about race, religion, identity, or anything that you would like Austin to comment on this thorny ground that we go through, because we have this thing of getting cancelled here in
yes,
the UK, and people are finding out about dreadful things people have done 10 or 15 years later. You are a sensitivities editor, or you hold courses on that. What does that involve?
A sensitivity reader, and I'm I guess I'd call myself an expert in a number of areas, obviously. I can help people show their African-American characters more honestly and more realistically, but also in the broader general landscape, try to put a writer in the right mindset. And there are some basic things that people do that are wrong, that they don't know are wrong, simply because we all have our own blind spots, right? Mm-hmm. We all have pictures in our minds of groups of people that may not be true or may not be consistent. And I will quickly share with you one of mine. In the brief time that I spent in London, I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised to see people drinking coffee. Now, I know that's silly, but I had it in my head. Well, in England, everyone just drinks tea. Well, that's a stereotype.
Yeah.
And it's a silly one. And yeah, if I wrote that in a book and it was sold in your country, everybody would laugh. Well, that's the kind. The kind of silliness. I try to get people to illustrate their characters evenly. In other words, if you have two friends and you are writing and you describe this woman is blonde and she's blue-eyed and she has very straight teeth, and she's a little heavy, and she's self-conscious about her weight, but she tries to dress well for it. And then when you get to her friend, well, her friend is black. Well, if that's all you say.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes.
And then you move on.
Yeah.
Then people who are more melanated like myself,
yeah,
that's a little offensive. Now, this character is just a flat character, and this character's three-dimensional. You don't want to do that.
And so if you want to lessen the significance of the character that's described as black, you could describe them with one word, but it wouldn't be black, because obviously you build some characters up and others are sort right of ciphers in there.
Right.
So you would say it's a attractive woman, or it's a 32-year-old something or, yeah, whatever.
Okay. But if you're going to give us lots of detail about all of the white guys, give us lots of detail about the other people. I as a writer, know better than to say, and Billy is an Inuit or an Eskimo.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot more to that individual than just that. And let's flesh them out a little more. And they're good. If I can get on my soapbox for a second.
Yes.
There are good reasons for this, for having your eye on that. And as a writer, I got to say that the number one big reason is there's a hungry market out there for more diverse characters. Readers want to see that. So it's something you ought to do if you want to have a broad readership. You gotta mix them up a little bit. And honestly, it makes you a better writer.
And tell me, Austin, the things that you're pointing out now, that very stark example you gave us, is that different from when I think your first Hannibal Jones was in 2003, so that's 20 years ago.
Yes.
Is that different writing?
I don't think my writing has changed. I think that I have always illustrated that, but I'm looking from the other side. The majority of my characters are minority characters in some way. They're Black or they're Latino. So I was very careful when I introduced the white character to give that character a fair show too, because I know that it will turn my audience off if I treat those people differently.
Oh, and he's white, and move on, you mean?
Exactly. Exactly. And then they met the cop, the white guy. And he's and in fact, Hannibal has kind of a posse of his own that hangs out with him. Mm. And they're an interesting group. Sarge is a retired Marine. Quaker used to be a drug user. Ray is a Cuban guy who owns his own taxi company. And there's Quaker. And Quaker's a white guy.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are jokes about the fact that, you know, someone will mention some rap music and Quaker will know the words to the lyrics, and he'll say, "What, the white guy can't like hip hop?" You know?
So that's sort of it all. Yeah.
I'm trying to show that these individuals are individuals, and that of course is the big point of all of this.
And
it's something that people miss.
As a sensitivity reader, are you hired by the authors or hired by the publishing companies? How does that work?
Usually, in my case, by the author.
Yeah.
I know that there are sensitivity readers that work for publishers, mm-hmm. but I'm usually working with the author. I usually come in during that second or third rewrite.
Okay.
When they've got their story pretty down and the words are all correct. And I'm the one who goes in and says, no, you know what? This particular sentence, that's not something that a Black woman who lives in Washington, D.C. would say.
Okay.
It's something like...
So you're a sort of cultural editor as well as a sensitivity editor.
Absolutely.
Rather like absolutely. I would tell you that we do actually drink coffee in the U.K.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If I had a British character who was central to my story,
yeah.
I would want to send it to you or someone like you and say, read this over and make sure I didn't do something stupid. And you would come back and say, no, silly, the engine's not in the under the hood, it's under the bonnet.
Yeah. And then talking of this cultural sensitivity thing, there are issues that now are more difficult to talk about, possibly to write about, as I said, race, religion, identity, all that
yes.
sort of stuff. How much more difficult is it to write about this than, say, when Ian Fleming was doing James Bond?
Oh, I think that Ian Fleming didn't have this or didn't face this. I was about to say something that wasn't true. I was about to say he didn't face this problem at all, but that isn't true. He did have some stereotypical characters in there, not just color-wise, but I think his Americans were very stereotypical. But in, I'm thinking it was the third novel. Can you tell I'm a James Bond fan? In Live and Let Die.
Okay, you are a James Bond fan, yes.
The villain is black. And in each of Bond's novels, toward the end, the villain gets to make a speech. It goes on for pages. And this particular character's speech was, I became a master criminal because it was the one area that black people have not excelled in. And I wanted to be the first, I wanted to break that barrier. And so now I am the big black villain. I remember I'm in high school reading that and I'm saying, wow, I hadn't even ever thought of it.
So you thought about doing a career change, did you, at that stuff?
No. No, I'm not smart enough to be a master criminal, and I'm too cowardly to be a petty criminal, so I can't do that. But, you know, and I think of, and I probably shouldn't, but I think of your work, which I am very impressed by, so your audience should know this, but I think part of the reason that we focus on these things, aside from, you know, I want to sell more books and whatnot, is maybe not so selfish. When people read your books, if you're a good writer and you are drawing us in, the reader starts to think that your book represents the real world. This is how things really are. And if you show people in a stereotypical way, people will think that's the way those people really are. If you write your entire book and you don't show any people that are different, readers will think that there are very few. I mean, for decades, I think, most Americans thought that there were very few homosexuals. They were this tiny little enclave off somewhere because we never saw them in books. We never saw them in movies. We never saw them on TV. So you're serving a purpose for the culture, for society, if you show that there is this mix.
This is fascinating, and I'm going to put you on the spot here. None of us might know it, or any of our audience, but what would you say would be the breakthrough book with a gay homosexual hero and with a black or Latino hero? Mm. I was thinking as you were saying that I couldn't think of. I remember the film Philadelphia.
Yes.
Which I think did that. And I also remember Sidney Poitier in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner as the film.
I think that for black American people, that movie was probably the leading edge. That was probably the break. Mm-hmm. Because it showed him as a real person and not some, you know, plastic stereotype. There's a there is a trope in American fiction that I refer to as the magical Negro, where, you know, this one individual like Uncle Remus or Bagger Vance, the legend of Bagger Vance, if you've seen that movie, he just is the wisest and most knowledgeable, but yet humble, and he saves the white guy's soul somehow. But yeah, let's not do that. Yeah, that's a bad thing. But it shows that people have had these pictures of anyone who's not themselves or not in their group, and those pictures are just inaccurate, and we need to make those pictures better.
And how does you talk about, you know, Sidney Poitier, we talk about this thing. How does this correlate with the cultural, political figures that are also coming up at that time? So when you had Sidney Poitier, and I might get all my dates wrong here, you were also having a civil rights movement in the States, yes, weren't you? Or you had your heroes coming out on the Vietnam War and that sort of thing. And does that all mesh together?
I think it does. The beginning of understanding is conversation, I think. And there was that time in the 1960s where for a little while, thanks to people like Martin Luther King, people stopped shouting at each other and started talking to each other. And that, I think, is the big, when you get past the, I don't like you because you're different. And you finally get to, we have a lot more in common, which is something else I teach in my class. We have a lot more in common than we are different. And you should focus on those things. Yeah. I don't care what you look like or where you come from. You like a good burger, you know?
Yeah. And of course, there's the music. And at that same time, you had Muddy Waters, say, and then the Rolling Stones taking from Muddy Waters and Elvis Presley. Well, and that was a sort of mixing together of stuff, wasn't it?
That's a whole other...
That's a whole other conversation.
American music, and to an extent, British music, has been an ongoing process of stealing from the black community.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Always.
Yeah.
Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, all the guys that I think of as great guitarists in the 1960s.
Yeah.
They were trying to play the blues. They wanted to be blues men.
They were, yeah. I once did a, this has got nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I'm going to say it anyway. I once did a story for the BBC. We went to Mali and we went to the place in a river there. And there was a musician called Alpha Kature there. And he took us there and he said, this is where the first blues riff was ever played.
Wow.
And he tracked us back, and then it went to the cotton fields of the South.
Yes,
of it, and then up from there, and that was what, you know, it was. Then you just sort of brought that to my mind. But I have to ask you this question because you did Hannibal Jones in 2003 and Go Away, and this thing about changing what's in books. Royal Dahl's being rewritten, people saying Shakespeare should be rewritten. I mean, what's your view?
My opinion is that's a bad thing. And I'll tell you why. When a book is published, among other things, it is a capsule of that time. It represents that time period. And I don't like the idea of revisionist history. You know, Mark Twain's character, who is generally referred to as Nigger Jim, that book has been banned in places because of the use of that word. But if you read that book, you have a picture of what people were thinking and how people were behaving at that time. And if you really read Tom Sawyer, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, I think you'll find that Jim is the only morally straight adult they meet in the entire book. Everybody else they meet is crooked in some way.
So Jim is the hero.
Yes. So I think that history should remain history. Books that have been written and published should be as they were.
Yeah.
And if it's a children's book, Roald Dahl is a great example. Yeah. It's great stuff. And as an adult, you should be able to say, okay, well, in this part, he was a little off base saying this. But everything else is great. So why? No, I don't like the idea of going back.
Yeah, so you keep it. And the we've had a whole heap of statues pulled down here, and I think you've had the same thing.
Well, yes, we've had that? the same.
Yeah.
I don't. Again, you're trying to erase history when you should be looking more closely at it.
Yeah.
I don't know if today I would put up a statue to some Confederate general. But I do know that at one time, maybe 100 years ago, people saw that guy as a hero. Yeah. And for all I know, he was doing what he thought was the best thing.
Yeah.
So
the next statue should be to Bill Gates and Hannibal Jones and the symbols of our modern day. Now you the subtle felon is out or just out in the past few hours, I think.
Yes.
And you have a launch in a bookstore in Maryland. I saw as I was scrolling through Twitter. Just give us an idea of what that's going to be like. What's the bookstore like? Who's going to come?
Actually, I've this time I do have to correct you, because the launch is not in a bookstore; it's in a restaurant.
Oh, okay.
Elaine's is a very nice eating establishment that serves Middle Eastern cuisine, which my wife is in love with. But it is owned by an author named Jeffrey James Higgins, and he is making his restaurant into kind of a literary hub. So he hosts book launches and readings and things like that. I'm going to go and Jeff is going to interview me, much as you are, for about, you know, half an hour or so. And then we'll get questions from whoever came. We'll have some nice beef bites or some sort of snacks that we'll have for people. Got some little giveaways to give folks.
Okay.
And then we'll line everybody up and say, buy a book, doggone it, and I'll sign.
and anybody can, because you're part of the Maryland writers community, and I just want to get a sense of the, you know, we talk about diversity, thrillers or whatever. Would, you know, there's types of people in this community that...
I will tell you that Maryland and the D.C., we refer to it as the DMV, which is the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia.
Right.
Kind of one big space.
Yeah.
And it is a very diverse community. Very diverse community. And you go to the grocery store, you're going to hear five or six different languages. You're going to see people dressed every kind of way and playing every kind of music. It's a rich soup. And so, and of course, we have every kind of restaurant, which I personally love.
And every kind of writer.
And every kind of writer. Last year, you know, we do this conference, which we call the Creatures, Crimes, and Creativity Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always surprised, because we will have authors there who are gay. We will have authors there who are Black, white, Asian. And in the writing community, nobody really cares. It's all about, but do you write well?
Yeah. And what do you say? Who are your characters?
Exactly.
This conversation that we're having now. Yes.
Do I like these people that I'm reading about? Do I want to be friends with your hero? And I talk to not just mystery writers and thriller writers, but also a lot of science fiction people and fantasy writers. And they take even bigger leaps in terms of the character's sexuality, or, you know, where the character's from and what they look like.
Yeah. And is there a sort of general agreement on the way, because we talked about the sensitivity, readership, the way literature or writing is going, or are some people pulling in one conversation and some pulling in others?
I think it all mixes up.
Yeah.
I don't feel a lot of pull this way and that. except perhaps in terms of language. And that's a difficult one for me and for some of my friends, for example, this might surprise you and it might not. To my white friends, the word nigger is a curse word. They would use the F word before they would use that word.
Yeah.
To my black friends, it's common. It's sometimes a term of endearment. And when I'm writing my book, I have to be careful because my audience is very broad and very diverse, and I don't want to offend people, but I also want my dialogue to be natural. And so it's very difficult.
So when you're talking to your black friends, you will use what we call the N-word just yes. to start a conversation without anybody Absolutely. Blinking.
I might... Now I'm gonna turn off half of your audience, and I don't want to do that.
No, I think my audience are fascinated in this.
I might use that word in place of if I say to you, you're my buddy, you're my pal.
Yeah.
I might use that word instead.
Oh my goodness.
Billy, he you know. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And in a similar way, women I know, I don't know, is the word bitch a really bad word in your place?
It's sort of mid-ranking bad. Yeah.
Okay.
But we can
use women might use that word for their friends. Now, no woman wants a man to call her that.
Yeah.
But they might, okay, we going out tonight and I'm going to get my bitches and we go into the club.
Oh, my goodness. So Austin, that is so fascinating. But can you just wait? I have to tell everybody what's coming up. Then I want to get back to this and get a final thought from you because
okay.
you have just turned on your head everything, a lot of the stuff that we hear in in Britain about what is acceptable and what isn't. But tomorrow coming up, we have our book of the month, which is Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. That's a journey deep into the jungle and into our souls. And I'm reading it at the moment, and it's a thin book. So pick it up if you can. And if you haven't read it but want to join, think about the movie Apocalypse Now, because that great movie is based on that. October the 3rd, I'm with Paul de Savary on Purpose, Passion, and Grit. He's a man with a mission to transform our social care because his daughter, Laura, has complex special needs. Britain has no way of looking after her. So 20 years ago, Paul set up his own system and provision, which is now seen as a model for others. Lucinda, October 5th, is with the wonderful Rory Heflin-Jones for a live event at the Riverstone Theatre in Fulham, London. And it's on Zoom, of course. Rory will be talking about Parkinson's disease, technology. He used to be the BBC technology correspondent, so he knows all about gadgets and what he has discovered about his own family with his latest book. October 6th, AJ Chambers, that's a pseudonym if ever I've heard one, and his debut novel on the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And jumping to October the 27th, Lucinda's book of the month is Whalebone Theatre by Joanna Quinn, an old English manor house by the sea, three children and a whale washed up on the beach. You would need some cultural sensitivity reading for that old English manor house, wouldn't you, Austin?
I'd need an expert to tell me exactly what's in there and what it looks like.
Have you read Heart of Darkness? Do you know it?
I've read Heart of Darkness so many decades ago that I don't remember much of Conrad's work, but I have watched Apocalypse Now several times, so I know what the story is.
That's a brilliant movie. Now you so sort of, I don't know what you call, mind flummoxed me with that last one that we are way out of time. But before you go, Goldster is for the over 50s. It's about healthy aging and staying active. What are your tips, Austin, for anybody? I know you're only 35, but what are your tips
about
for anybody?
35 is way in my rearview mirror, but But if I were to give somebody tips, I'd say, well, I'll tell you what I do. I walk. I get my 10,000 steps every day. I stay hydrated. I make sure I drink 7 or 8 glasses of water every day. And I like to do puzzles in addition to making puzzles. So I do matching things like Mahjong online, things like that. That keeps my brain up and running. Okay. But geez, I think reading your books is a way to keep your mind.
you played Mahjong online, the Chinese game?
Yes. There is a place online where you can go and get that. It's you know, the tiles.
Yeah.
And you have to find the ones that match, and they're stacked up. So you have to, you know, and it's a search and match kind of games. I enjoy them, and they keep my brain going.
That is brilliant. Mahjong, you're the first one that's recommended that, plus the puzzles, plus the walking, and the general optimism and happiness that you've given to us all today. But that is it. That is it. My great friend, who I've never met, I wish I could come to your launch, but we will at one stage get together. The wonderful, charismatic, and captivating Austin S. Camacho. If you like Austin, try Subtle Felonies and see if you like Hannibal Jones too. What a lovely Gold Star conversation you've given us. Until tomorrow, when we journey into the Gold Star heart of darkness, stay active, stay curious, stay walking, stay doing puzzles. Check out Playing Mahjong. And of course, stay Gold Star. Thank you, Austin S. Camacho, for being such a fun and brilliant guest. Bye.
Goodbye, everyone. It's wonderful to be here. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks so much. Get some sleep now.
Yes, that's my next step.
Thank you for listening, and find out our vast range on www.goldstar.co.uk. Our vision is to help people stay stimulated, active, socializing, and empowered in what we say live happier and healthier for longer. The podcast is one of many strands, which includes nutrition, yoga, art, singing, languages, brain power, love, and many, many others, more than 300, all from the comfort of your home. If you like what you hear, please press that big subscribe button and tell your friends, family, colleagues, community, and yes, your enemies too, about what Gold Star does. Spread the word about our incredible range of guests and subject, and until next time, goodbye from all of us at Gold Star.